agenda except 9A and 9D. 9E.
So forest resources, Steve Valzano and Aaron Lynham are going to present.
So I'll refer to the policy paper, Forest Integrity Protection Requirements, and open up to any questions. Again, just as a brief preamble, Forest is intended to get to two issues. One, defining what is a significant ecological resource. Forest is a prominent resource, very important resource of the region that provides numerous ecological benefits. And it's important to look at those ecological benefits based upon the extent of contiguous forest area to maintain ecological processes. And that's somewhat independent of watershed considerations. However, forest is also a very important indicator of water quality and important to maintain for purposes of protection of water quality. And that is based upon a watershed basis. So there are both ecological or what we call forest patch considerations, the extent of the contiguous forested area, and then there are watershed considerations and the extent of forest within a watershed. And the policy paper looks to address both those considerations. Item number one is the recognition of inclusion of forest resources, not only in the regional master plan, which is a requirement of the act, but also to incorporate it as a factor in defining appropriate zones in the land use capability map. Item number two is to establish or evaluate the ecological integrity of forest and define a forest resource area based upon a number of indicators of quality of forest. Those indicators of quality of forest or ecological integrity include total forest area, core area, which is the amount of forest that is distant from an edge. Edge has very deleterious effects on forest ecology. The amount of forest that's available that's a greater distance from an edge is higher quality than those forests that approximate to the edge. Forest patch size, which is a measure of contiguity or how contiguous the forest cover is, and proportion of total forest, which is a measure of not only forested area, total forested area, but over a unit area, how much of the landscape is in forest. They are all measures or indicators of forest fragmentation. Fragmentation of forest is bad for both water quality and for ecological processes. And these are a number of forest fragmentation indices that are used to assign regional significance. For purposes of defining a forest resource area, we are including all forests that have a patch size greater than 500 acres. Ecologically, you get greater species diversity, greater species survivability. When you have large forest patch areas, the literature supports large forest patches as being areas that are generally 500 acres or more of total contiguous land area. Forest resource area also includes those lands that have core area of greater than 250 acres. Species that require what's called forest interior, or that portion of the forest that's distant from the edge, core area, generally have greater survivability and in areas of core forest that are greater than 250 acres, and that's well supported in the literature. And then a total proportion of forest cover of greater than 45%. Again, the effects of fragmentation become much more profound when the proportion of forest cover over landscape starts dipping at lower levels. 45%, again, supported through the scientific literature, is where you start to see species losses or loss of ecological processes when total forest cover across the landscape starts dipping below 45%. When you're above 45%, even though your remaining forest may be fragmented, you still retain most of the ecological processes that forests provide. So those are the three criteria that are used to define what we term our forest resource area that will be incorporated into the land use capability map.
I still don't understand that. 45% of mean total forest cover.
Yeah, it's
how is this
That in order to do a percent of forest cover, you have to pick a unit of, or an area of measure. So that you can, because the unit of measure in our case is the percent of forest which is within 3 kilometers of any given point on the ground. So that when you, 45% looks at how much cover there is in proximity to any given point, so as you move through the region, the total forest cover changes. The mean total forest cover changes. So what it does is it's a measure of how to identify that land area within the region that is predominantly forest from that area of the region that is predominantly non-forest.
We're going to go across the road. How would we compute this?
Well, it uses a very complex model that takes a point on the ground, establishes a 3-kilometer circle, it's called a roving window, calculates the percent,
gotcha.
Moves 10 feet over, does the same calculation, moves 10 feet over, does the same calculation. So it creates a database that looks at the distribution of percent forest cover throughout the region and is used to distinguish those lands that are predominantly forested from those lands that are predominantly non-forested.
Sorry, I asked.
Thank
you, Steve.
That's okay. Item number 3. So where item number 2 looks at the extent of forest cover that is regionally significant for ecological processes, item number 3 looks at what the forest value is in terms of providing important water quality benefits. So it looks at the watershed level considerations and identifies 3 value classes of watershed, of forest integrity as it relates to watershed functions, high, moderate, and low. And those are based upon, again, a combination of the indicators, the forest resource value indicators that I spoke of earlier. To, again, distinguish between, at a HUC 14 or at a sub-watershed level, what watersheds are really important because of their forest characteristics to protect in order to protect water quality. And which of those which HUCs have such minimal forest as the forest provides less value for protection of water quality. So it really is just looking at, again, distinguishing portions of the Highlands region based upon their ability to provide important water quality protections, benefits, and then providing protection measures through inclusion of different zones and standards that maintains that public benefit. Protection of forests for continued water quality benefit.
Can I ask you a question? And Tom, you're included. 13:20-28 is the exemptions portion of the Act, right? So in it, the preamble is the following are exempt from the provisions of this Act, the Regional Master Plan, any rules, regulations adopted by the DEP pursuant to this Act, or any amendments to a master plan, development regulations, or any regulations adopted by a local government unit to specifically conform with the regional master plan. Boom, then it lists them. And of course, you know that 7 is an activity conducted in accordance with an approved woodland management plan, or the normal harvesting of forest products in accordance with a forest management plan approved by the state forester. So in essence, I understand all the ecological and environmental reasons why contiguous forest is important to what the goals of the Act are. But in essence, this forestry management component is almost a nice suggestion to landowners but it doesn't have a lot of enforcement teeth.
Remember, what section are you citing?
13:20.
It's 30, section 30 of the Act.
Has
17 exemptions, but you're right. Any activities that fall within those 17 exemptions are fully exempt, not only from the DEP rules, but from the Regional Master Plan and any municipal or county ordinance that's implementing the Regional Master Plan. It may be, though, that the state forester, looking at our Regional Master Plan, would update the state forester's requirements. And so we still should inform that decision-making process so that a state forester's review of it should look to the Regional Master Plan. But clearly they would be exempt from any requirements.
So then we might need to look at some nice incentives if you want to get people
to that's correct.
Participate or conform with the recommendations that we're going to put in the master.
That's correct.
And we would be able to perhaps use these recommendations on publicly owned lands.
Without a doubt. That would go to the coordination aspect of the plan, that state agencies or other entities that hold land should manage them properly.
I just don't want to lose sight of where we're going with this, as far as the forestry component.
Yeah, and I think that's acknowledged that our hopes and desires are that regional conservation priorities or concerns will inform those land management practices, whether on private or public lands, as one benefit of this. But more importantly, is identifying where forest constitutes a significant regional resource that is necessary to protect, either through controls on land uses, standards relating to site plan design, or priorities and strategies for open space acquisition that provides maximum benefit to as many people as possible, which is water quality and ecological process plan.
Have you prepared an overlay of the forested areas that fit the standards?
Yes.
Do we have that?
Yes.
I mean, can we look at it, or is it buried someplace? If it's buried, it's not a big deal.
Yes.
I'm just interested to see how that overlay fits with the watershed overlay, which fits with one of the other overlays. Because it seems to me, once we get all these overlays, there's going to be tiny little pockets that maybe are going to be the 4% development areas.
Yeah, it actually, we'll show you the results of the forest. So there's...
Feel free to continue while he's here.
So total, do you have... So essentially, we looked at the individual indicators. This is the dark green and the olive green.
Thanks.
The dark green and the olive green is the total forest air cover within the Highlands region. You can see it's pretty broken up. There's, you know, a lot of intervening other uses, developed lands, agricultural lands. This distinguishes between core forests greater than 250 acres and all remaining forests. So those areas you see in dark green are the most high ecological value from the perspective of core forest area. Another indicator, which one do you have on your next? Which is the proportion of total forest area using the 45% threshold. Again, total. You could see the distinction between the total forest in dark green and light olive, and then the area that constitutes greater than 45% proportion of total forest in the dark green. Oh, this is patch size, greater than 500 acres, I'm sorry. So this is patch size. So these are forested areas that have patch sizes greater than 500 acres. There's going to be a lot of overlap between this and core forest because you have to have a large patch in order to have a high core area. But this is more extensive coverage than the previous one and then the third one.
Proportion
of total forest, which is Mimi, this is the one you had, 45%. So this looks at the extent of forest cover which consists of at least 45% of total forest cover in proportion to land area. And that land area is a 3-kilometer window. It's a landscape level analysis. So it's those three metrics that define regionally significant forest resources from regionally less significant forest resources, although arguably all forest is important. And it comes up with this, which is the forest cover that represents a significant ecological resource to the highlands for which we believe and recommend to the council is necessary to protect, maintain, restore, and enhance to the extent that's possible through the implementation of the regional master plan.
Now, do we have the ability to take that overlay and then take the water recharge overlay and put them over?
Yes, and then actually that's where what staff is working on right now is the integration of all these, and why when we talk about maximum extent practical or possible or wherever possible, it's because we recognize there's certain situations where you can't include all variables. There's just, I mean, as you can see from this, there's just too much variability. So there are certain circumstances in which there you don't include everything. You try to include the majority. And where it's not included, there has to be protection standards through site plan review that still doesn't compromise that public benefit. But recognizes that not everything could be included within an appropriate zone.
Where
so
we get the state in this map state.
Well, we're still developing a lot of the information that will be presented to the council during the work sessions that will extend into October. So a lot of what you're telling us now, or a lot of what we're interpreting that you're telling us now, we'll go to inform this so we could go to the next step, which is the integration, and then we'll present the integrated layers as they inform the different zones. But
records data?
What's that?
Is this records data?
No, actually, this is a combination of the data that was developed by Rutgers, Chris, Center for Remote Sensing and Spatial Analysis and STIT. And then, so these are the results of the ecological indicators. Do you have the forest resource area delineation? So, and then turn off the forest. So essentially what we did is, now we take land, you can't see it. turn back.
Put any color in there.
Essentially what we take that data extraction now, which is the extent of forest that's important from a regional perspective to protect the ecological processes, and we define an area within which all those that forest is regionally significant. We call that the forest resource area. So it doesn't include all forests; it just includes forests that we consider regionally significant. That's the dark black line that you can see there. Forest is a major driver. It's going to be a major driver in the plan. It is a very good indicator of both ecological quality and water quality. So it is a major driver. What's that? Yes. And when I say ecological, it's habitat for both terrestrial and aquatic species. So, it is a very good indicator of environmental quality. And it has tremendous air quality benefits as well. I mean, the whole issue of global warming and carbon sequestration, maintaining functioning, intact, ecologically healthy forested communities is very important to air quality as well, both locally and globally.
Can we address anywhere the fact that the excessive deer population and its browsing has destroyed the mature deciduous forest regeneration?
Yeah, there is a policy recommendation recognizing the damage that deer overpopulation is doing on forest regeneration and forest health. There is a policy recommendation that deals with that issue.
That we're getting to.
Yes.
I'll let you say that.
So then, so this is ecological. Then we also have, we used forest as indicators for watershed condition. And why don't you just go ahead and we'll just... and again, those are based upon a relative scale of high, moderate, low, to just sort of simplify what has been a very challenging and complex process. And we start looking and defining significance throughout the region and dividing land by very significant and less significant in terms of its ability to provide, for forests to provide water quality benefits based upon a series of indicators. This is one indicator, which is...
Forest.
What's that?
Percent core forest.
Okay, using the same indicators. This is core forest, but it's expressed at a watershed level. And you can start seeing the dark blue is very important, high quality from a water quality perspective. The yellow is more impaired. I mean, the forest provides less water quality benefits. And then
percent total forest.
Again, using another metric, and this is that 45%. This is the area, the watersheds, in which the total forest cover within the watershed still provides important water quality benefits. So there is, forest is still an important component of the landscape and throughout much of the region. And then
the proportion of the total forest.
Oh, this was patch size, yeah. Sorry.
It's very similar.
Yeah. And then this is the proportion of the total forest. So that these are used, what's that?
Computer box.
I'm jumpy.
It's a message from Argentina for one of my sons.
It is then there's a process that we went through to use the indicators to essentially identify high integrity forest areas, moderate integrity, low integrity, and that too informs the protection needs within sub-watershed areas throughout the region. And you can start to see, I mean, where areas that possess less value, the flip side of that is that those are areas that would be more appropriate to accommodate growth, providing there are other provisions available, like infrastructure capacity. So, and the dark blue here is what's really important. And does that help? Item number.
It's just to see the multiple stuff.
Stay tuned.
You should stop by one day.
Not today.
Not today.
Yeah, it's coming. Item number four. Now, using these forest resource area and the variables that we developed to evaluate forest value, these are the policy recommendations that inform development of the different zones using forest of the land use capability map. And certainly there's the recognition to include all of the forest resource area or those real high ecological value forested areas into the regional protection zone, but again, to the maximum extent practical, is an intent to acknowledge that it's never going to be 100%, but certainly we're shooting towards 100%. Secondly, is to include all of those high integrity forested areas, again, to the maximum extent practical, based upon their water quality benefits. And then generally, within the regional protection zone, is to and I'm going to use a verb that it's going to get me in trouble no matter which one I use, but is to discourage, prohibit, restrict clearing activities, except where the council determines an area is a specially planned area or otherwise appropriate for growth. Even within those zones and within those watersheds, there are existing developed areas that we don't want to the council will feel is appropriate for redevelopment, and should they be defined as specially planned areas, then we would allow some additional flexibility at a municipal level so that that redevelopment can occur without impairing the resource, which is forest.
I have a question on that one. Shouldn't we say, rather than should, shall, just because it's more clear? In that third bullet, and then is this term exceptional circumstances determined by public good, is that from the Act?
Yeah, and I would say when we get to conformance, in all situations there will be public health and safety provisions that are necessary to provide some measurable degree of relief in the interest of maintaining, protecting, and safeguard public health and safety. And
but we haven't been saying that in these papers when we get to discussions, particularly where we're talking about the regional protection zone. we haven't been using that phrase. I'm just wondering why it appears here. We haven't seen it before, and if we're covered, you know, in some other place that says, you know, we all of these things are subject to certain prescriptions in the Act, then I don't see the point of putting
it. We can cover it on the way, because the waiver provision addresses that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
To Tracy's point, shall is a legal term.
Right.
Not necessarily a narrative term. Which
well, I like that it was no clearing the forest. Very clear. And then it says should. And it makes it sound like, gee, we should. It just sounds so.
Understood.
Like with something very specific, and then it's softened up with the word should. You know, then we can use will. But, I mean, just something that keeps it as clear as it, the sentence began.
Let there be no clearing for us.
Yeah, I like that.
You're biblical?
Yeah. Okay, we're going to do it on
stones.
We're going to do stones, Jack, put that on.
We're going to be referring to this as the Bible.
As somebody who's paid a little bit of attention to the Right to Farm Act and so on and so forth, the ability to say you can't clear is kind of meaningless, which we've said already. And in fact, you're almost certainly, you're crazy not to be engaged in silviculture if you decide to clear a forest. So I make that observation as a preamble to saying, I think our strictures here ought to be more constraining than to say no clearing, and again, be driving toward, you know, some ordinance-type language, if not getting to it, for all of these municipalities. Because this thing, bizarrely enough, is not restrictive at all. If I decide to clear a piece of property, I'm going to sell those trees, and then I fall out from under the ambit of this entirely.
But that's within an approved forest management plan, Michael. That's within an approved forest management plan.
No, sir. Not under the Right to Farm Act. Pretty sure, Jack.
See, there's some
but even apart from that, even I threw that out in a way I didn't need to talk about it at all. But my real observation is we ought to have something that's more restrictive. Maybe that's not the right word, but more concerned, more nuanced than no clearing. I'd be willing to bet that more than half of the municipalities now maybe I shouldn't. I was going to say more than half of the municipalities that are in the preservation area have something that's more restrictive than this already. Yeah, that's what.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not proposing one. I'm just, I'm in effect saying to the staff, I'd like to see this thought through again and come up with something.
Well, what does clearing mean? Does that mean cutting down any tree? What does clearing mean? Is cutting 100 trees, is that clearing?
Removing forest cover from a land area that could be
everything.
Yes.
Well, I don't think we want them to even get that close. We don't want them to half clear or a quarter clear.
I was just going to say that I think Michael brings to bear again what I was suggesting earlier that I don't see where we have a tremendous amount of authority here, and that I think. It's great to say we want this, we want this, we want this, we want this, and there could be some very sound reasons why we want it. But in order for it to work, we're going to have to really get people to join in voluntarily through incentive programs for it to work. Because, for some reason, the legislature, when they wrote the law, specifically talks about forestry practices separate from the rest of agriculture, but forestry is an agricultural practice. You are guaranteed the right to harvest your agricultural output and sell it. You do have to do it with a forestry management plan, but even in here it acknowledges that it does not have to be a plan that's approved by the state forester. There's two routes. You can have a private forester and have your plan and it's approved and you do it. And there's even agroforestry where you clear and sell everything for pulpwood and you might go back and replant fast growing poplars. And it would be in accordance with the soil and water management plan, conservation plan under farm. So I think we need to recognize that there's lots of ways that people can do really good stewardship and management practices, and there's some ways that some unscrupulous people can do some nasty things. And so I think we really need to be set our sights on, how do we get people to join in and do a really good job of stewardship.
And we start to get
touch on this.
I have a fundamental question then. But that's not true when the land use is changing, right?
Correct.
I think you're overstating how much our hands are tied. Our hands are only tied when we're talking about a continued agricultural or forestry use. When there's going to be a development application, land use is changing, this all applies.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think what we're talking about here has a lot more import than what you're stating. And I also think if you don't like the word clearing, or, you know, you could say cutting, no cutting of trees. That might be more to the point.
Right.
I think, you know, and then we need to,
that
in our glossary. Well, I think that's what they, when I read it, no clearing of trees to me meant no cutting of trees, but maybe that I was right.
That's not what these gentlemen meant.
But I think that we should then in our glossary have these terms defined. So, you know, we're all assuming certain things when we read these words, and they're not, we're not agreeing. You know,
that's the first thing I
agree. You could buy a 100-acre tract that's forested, that's never been farmland assessed. And you can get a forester, get an approved management plan, get farmland assessment, and do everything right, and then decide you don't want to farm anymore and stop and do some major highlands development.
Yeah,
after you've done your
you're
treatment.
Talking about a, you know, somebody going a circuitous route, and yes, developers do that kind of thing all the time. But in fact, when a development application is going to come in a forested area, this is going to apply to them. If they have forests, if they have trees, and these various permutations that we've seen, how good the quality is going to prescribe what you can and cannot do.
My point is, you're going to do your tree activities before you decide to become a major highland.
Not necessarily. You're assuming every farmer is going to be a developer. I'm just saying that's.
Or assuming every developer is going to be a forester.
and we should guard against that. And there are a lot of people who would take advantage and do take advantage every day of those circumstances. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to regulate change in land use and forests. We've got to do this.
Agreed. And please observe that when they say no clearing, we're talking about cutting all the trees. So I'm in complete agreement with you. We ought to have something that is more nuanced than that. And I think your no cutting any trees may be a little severe.
But that pruning?
But we don't.
Yeah. Right, that's cutting. So
but you do have to allow for people to harvest wood if they want to heat their homes with wood. I mean, you know, right. There's certain fundamental rights. You know, if you plant a tree and then you decide you want to cut the tree down, you know, that's a resource that people are buying. You know, and a lot of people, especially with oil prices, are turning to alternative fuels. I mean, so we do need to recognize that there has to be some sort of balance. And if they want to, and if they are doing a good job of stewardship, you know, they're going to be replanting the trees, doing selective harvests, cutting down.
Well, let me, rather than this, why don't Steve, why don't you go through a couple more of these policies?
Sure. And the just to add on Kurt's, that most forest in the region has to be managed, so it requires some level of intervention, and we should be able to encourage that. So we're on the second page, on page 3, continuing on the policy recommendations relating to regional protection zone, is such as a situation that may occur within a specially planned area that allows for some degree of forest clearing, that forest clearing should be minimized, and mitigation and restoration of forested areas will need to be provided. As an incentive is to provide prioritization on both acquisition and or TDR credit bonuses, which we're going to get into a greater discussion on TDR at a subsequent meeting, for lands that are within the forest resource area. So provide a benefit and an incentive to those landowners that choose to maintain that forest in accordance with the goals of the regional master plan. Provide them with an incentive through TDR bonuses or credit bonuses or through acquisition prioritization.
But just a question on that. You said we're going to get into TDR, and I know we probably have a policy paper at some point that will come up. But just a thought that occurred to me when I read this is that I see what you're saying, but on the other hand, if there's a lot of other protection strategies and ways to protect the most pristine areas, should we be using our TDR credit bonuses there? And should we not be thinking about our TDR sending areas to be areas that are less protected by other aspects or elements of our protection strategies?
Just a thought. I just add to that, though. I guess I just had exactly the opposite thought, Tracy, which is, listening to the discussion, it sounds to me like, despite the fact that this act was written to at least in part protect forests are going to be very vulnerable, that we're not going to have a lot of direct controls over them. And I think Kurt's point in Michael's observation is one that we've all heard about as a criticism of the farmland assessment program, that a lot of the land that's farmland assessed is held by developers. And there's nothing that I see here that could stop them coming in and clearing that land prior to becoming enacting the development plan. So I think we need that kind of assessment, a much more detailed assessment as to how protected are these resources. I don't disagree with the policy direction here that we ought to be giving them the greatest amount of protection possible. We ought to really be taking a hard-nosed look at the tools we have at hand, because if they are vulnerable or they're not reachable through the regulatory tools, then they should be prioritized for open space acquisition or TDR. And that's an assessment we really ought to have to inform policy decisions here. I guess just by extension of that, the TDR only talks about it within the regional protection area as opposed to throughout the region.
Right, that was one of my points, that bullet should go under the next one.
If you're within a TDR sending area and a forest resource area, that you would be entitled to bonuses for enhanced protection to those forest resources within that land. So essentially the landowner is getting a benefit for being steward of the resource that is within their land.
Seems to me we also might make recommendations to the legislature, state forest, and we might ask you to lay those out for us.
And that's coming. The finally is within the regional protection zone is to encourage forest management and restoration practices on both public and private lands that prioritize the ecological and watershed processes that we're trying to protect. Item number five, regional conservation zone. So this is policies guidance that relates to defining the regional conservation zone, the land use capability map, that recognizing that in the event that all that is the inclusion of these moderate integrity forested areas or those lighter colored watersheds that aren't included in the protection area should, as much as possible, be included in the conservation zone to provide a heightened level of protection. Essentially, we want to discourage putting moderate to high forested areas into areas that are designated for growth, because growth, by their very nature, require land clearing and forest losses. Item number two, that within the regional conservation zone is to require forest protection restoration plans and low impact development best management practices to mitigate for forest resource losses. Where protection, you're trying to maintain the uses. Here, we're trying to encourage restoration of any alteration. So it provides the ability to alter, but requires restoration of any losses. It's just a lesser standard. Thirdly, is to encourage forest management and restoration practices on public and private lands to prioritize ecological watershed protection measures. Again, for land management activities, we want to try to bring that management objective and goal in conformance with the plan so the developer doesn't clear under forest management plan with the intent to develop and skirt any standards. Six, regional development zone. These are standards that would apply to those areas that are targeted for growth, and generally it's just to require low-impact development BMPs for any development activity to minimize clearing of forest. Forest losses are acknowledged to occur within a development zone.
I'd just like to add to that that there should be some attempt to have restoration of trees and replant after the development is done.
I was going to say that too, and I think you get there by including the third bullet under number five, mm-hmm. under this bullet, yeah. under this right. Number six.
Same wording.
Right.
You know, you might actually fit within the ambit of the Right to Farm Act by requiring an enormous number of trees to be replanted based upon the number of trees that have been taken down within some period of time.
That's right.
You might as well find that does not impinge upon the right to farm, because somebody who continues farming is in fine shape, and somebody who changes and switches then is bitten beyond. You know what I'm saying, Tim? You're a little puzzled. I mean, let's suppose I go out and buy 100 acres. I'm not even going to bother with a forest management plan. I'm going to declare myself to be a farm because I'm going to harvest $2,500 of timber a year. I think that does it. I do that for 3 years running. And then I cut down every last tree on that 100 acres, and I decide to put up something. And now I've become a developer. That might, having me have to go back and, let's say, I cut down 1,000 trees of, you know, caliper 3 feet or something, and I've got to be 3 times that many trees or whatever, or 10 times that many trees, that might actually work with the Right to Farm Act.
I would take exception, because Right to Farm does not allow cavalier activity. You have to, your right to farm is protective soil. If only you're in conformance with best management practices and clear cutting without a forestry management practice or plan approved by a forester would not be something that would be protected. So I would take that to task. That you just like I can't go and plow up and down a hill with an old moldboard plow and then have tons of erosion, have the soil go onto the neighbor's property, to have that neighbor then make a complaint that I've got all this erosion that went into a neighbor's property. I wouldn't be protected by Right to Farm, because the first thing NRCS would say, well, this wasn't done in conformance with the Soil and Water Conservation Plan. There should have been contour strips or conservation tillage practices. You're not protected by Right to Farm. And the same would occur with a forestry practice such as that. You know, you can't just go in.
Such as clear cutting, but that wasn't right. My example. My example was I cut over a period of 3 years, and I could cut a quarter of my or 12th of my property once every quarter. You could be right, Kurt, but with respect, I think you can do this and discover that you fit the definition of your farm, and you're not in violation of best management practices.
I don't think doesn't have the power to regulate the cutting of trees, per se.
No, in fact, the Highlands Act, I think, does allow us to do that by virtue of our responsibility for forests. I think we clearly are empowered to regulate it. And then the question is, where are we not empowered to regulate it? And
right.
We're limited by the Right to Farm Act.
That's correct.
I think,
generally. That's correct. Yeah. Okay.
Well, and we're limited by the language in the Act.
Yes.
Right. Yes. On exempt activities. Yeah. Item number 7, resource protection.
But on the other hand, I think it's important to note that the bulk of forest land is being managed by private landowners in a very responsible way. So, I mean, let's not lose sight of the fact that there's a lot of private property owners who want to do it right.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to keep in sight that, you know, with the proper incentives, we can achieve a tremendous amount of good, solid stewardship without a tremendous investment of billions of dollars to acquire it all.
Absolutely.
And I think that's where we got to keep our sights on.
Resource protection standards. So these are standards that apply to all forests within all zones at a time of review of a site plan application. And they include, one, restrict clearing activities and new land uses within the forest resource area or high integrity forest area. By default, most of those should be within the highly controlled regional protection zone, but if they're not, they can be captured and protected through site plan review applications as well.
Can we get a definition for land clearing activities?
Yes, there's that clearing word too. We'll use.
Clear that up.
We'll clear that up.
But are we going to leave the word clearing in everywhere? As opposed to taking down the cutting, and then we're going to have to define how much is cutting. And well, how much can
we have, we know we have to work on some way to define.
We'll qualify okay. that term.
So we don't have to bug you about that anymore.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. I promise.
Establish minimum site design guidelines and permissible uses within a forest area as follows. That within the forest resource area or a high integrity forest area, that uses should be limited to maintenance of pre-existing uses. So you don't want to encourage a use within a high resource area that results in a further impairment or degradation to the resource. That there will be certain instances, such as in specially planned areas, where some degree of relaxation of that standard would apply, but that would be very limited and only as specified by the Highlands Council. Acquisition and restoration of impaired areas within the forest resource area shall be encouraged. One thing that's interesting is that if, in order to maintain or enhance or restore even within the forest resource area, there's still a lot of fragmentation and degradation, that there'll be much greater benefit if restoration efforts are targeted within that area rather than throughout the entire region. So this looks to encourage restoration and give prioritization to restoration within a forest resource area. That's the high quality forest.
A question on that. Can we hear, or maybe it would be when we get further down the road into pre-conformance, but can we actually define here the types of land use that, can we say, and these land uses cannot happen there, such as ski slopes or golf courses? I mean, things that really require the clearing of a forest.
The intent of the standards is get to the activity, which is the clearing of forest, regardless of the use, and to provide the flexibility for a municipality to determine what that use should be, given the character of their municipality. I mean, generally, the approach that we've been going on and the whole purpose of overlay zones is that we don't have to get into specifying the type of use. Just regulating activities and any use that results in that activity that harms the resource. So whether it's a ski trail, a road, a golf course, or a residential development or a strip mall, if it clears forest, it's subject to these standards.
I hope that's going to work. Yeah.
There may be instances where prohibited uses for certain other resources used are necessary. But the approach we're taking is not to have that be the lead.
And when would that come about? When would we get to
that? I imagine, you know, gas stations in groundwater recharge areas or something along
those
lines.
There's going to be certain industrial uses.
Yes.
You know,
that's what Tim was alluding to before. Use issues may come up, but it's not the general approach we're trying to take.
And then with the wastewater treatment capacity, by limiting the extent of capacity, you're in effect limiting uses or choice of uses mm-hmm. outside of those service
areas.
You just
have to do a really good job at that
yeah.
in order to really have it be effective.
Item number B, permissible uses within a moderate integrity forest area shall be limited maintenance of pre-existing uses or allow for the clearing where restoration can be provided. So it essentially is saying that losses are allowable, providing that there's a requirement for restoration. And then item C is...
I'm repeating myself, but I think we ought to
be more
start specifying what we mean by restoration. I mean,
I agree.
There are lots of ordinances that do that. You take down a tree X at chest level, and you need to put up half of a tree or 17 trees or whatever.
I think we do talk about that later in here, right?
Not to that level of specificity, but that's the intent. Item number C is activities within a low integrity forest area shall encourage redevelopment of previously developed areas and allow for other uses that minimize losses of forest lands. In accordance with a forest protection restoration plan or low impact development. So essentially what that's saying is that when it's low integrity forest, you're still trying to discourage clearing,
minimize clearing, but you're allowing it with measures to restore. It's, again, a sliding scale or graduated levels of control or regulation on use.
I would suggest bringing in again that phraseology that we used earlier about restoration practices on that prioritize ecological and watershed protection measures. Say it other places. I think it'd be good to mention to repeat it there.
Okay. Yeah, it was in the first bullet. No, I'm sorry. It was in.
I don't think it's under this section.
Yeah, item five, the third bullet right. Under item five.
Yeah, I'm just saying move it under seven too.
Next is to establish minimum requirements for low-impact development BMPs. Specify exactly what those are. Require preparation of inclusion of forest protection restoration plans within municipal zoning and land use ordinances. Essentially, this is the, Mike gets to your issue, that when you cut a tree down to 12 inches, you have to replace it with five trees of 2 inches. Establish minimum requirements for incorporation of forest stewardship and management plans within municipal and county open space. So we're trying to prioritize not only acquisition, but management of those lands to maximize resource value, and also allow for some level of forest management practices on publicly owned lands where it's appropriate. Smart design standards, item number 8. These are the standards that apply within site plan review, within any zone, to encourage protection of the resource, but still through flexibility of design. Item number 1 is the recognition of inclusion of a standard methodology for determining what a forest is. We went through a process early on where we came up with a method that we submitted to DEP. DEP accepted it and is using it, so we want to make that the method for determining what a forest is.
Are we requiring municipalities to do this, or we're going to do it ourselves?
A municipality in a normal course site plan application would have to, as a checklist item, the applicant would have to demonstrate where a forest is on their property so that the municipal planning board can see the extent of the resource and what measures have been taken to minimize its harm. And so this would be the method in which the applicant would use to define or delineate the extent of forest that's on the plan that's submitted to a planning board. So the planning board would actually review the application against the standards that are contained in the regional master plan.
I guess that sort of makes sense to me if you weren't doing.
Well, we have the ability to do what's called a call-up provision. In some cases where it says, as approved by the Highlands Council, it's intended to be a step that an applicant has to come to the council for approval before it goes to the municipality. So whenever we get into these planning, like regional plans, where it's a burden to a town, then we would want the applicant to come to the council, get an approval of that planning element before they went to the municipality. So they go to the municipality with a letter in hand from the council. In most cases, though, particularly as it relates to site design, that is largely standards that we're trying to encourage towns to do consistently throughout the region. And then if they don't adhere to the standard, or if we have, if there's an indication that we disagree with the decision they made, then we have a call-up provision in which the council can essentially, has almost like a 30-day or 90-day veto period where the council can say, wait, we don't agree with the determination you made, so we want to review that determination with the planning board before that, let's say, preliminary site plan approval is ratified.
So theoretically, we haven't identified something as an upland forest, and yet we're requiring somebody, a landowner, to tell us that even though we haven't identified it as an upland forest, it is one.
Correct.
Now, for what it's worth, it seems a little backwards to me that one of the things that
we would like to be doing is identifying forests that are worried about.
And we have, to the maximum extent possible, within the limitations of working at 850,000 acres.
Well, I hear you. But if that's the best we can do, why should we be requiring somebody else to do something more? And I understand why they might be able to do something more, but especially over time, should we be able to do it? At least asking the question.
Yeah, in all situations, I mean, when we talk adjustments and revisions, in all situations, an applicant will have the ability both to refute what we map as forests, and an applicant will have to demonstrate that our data wasn't so limited as to miss an area of forest that may be important. So it creates a check and balances that benefit both sides of the equation. And by requiring it, you require a...
I hear what you're saying, Steve, and you know, it's not your statements are false, but to me, they're close to being asked. I mean, we ought to go out and identify the forests, and to the degree that they're important to identify beyond what we're able to do today, and I'm not saying we can't do it over time, we ought to continue to do it, and then somebody ought to be able to rely on us if we've said, this is not a forest. And not, you know, sort of putting their neck potentially in the noose by agreeing with us that it hasn't been identified as a forest and be required to say, you know, were if not wrong, were inadequate.
Do you know what? I would think that the planning board would know that an application was in an area that was forested, and that they themselves would be concerned knowing that they have bought into this. And, I mean, we have to understand that there are things that we are going to miss. It's not going to be incorporated in all the data that they've been collecting. And then we're going to have to continue to update these databases as we go along, because there will be, you know, subtle changes that go over.
But maybe what's the process for amending the plan? We have to go through a formal amendment process and six public hearings.
Every 6 years, yes.
No, but I mean, no. Between what Mimi's bringing up, how much of it is stuff we just flush out versus it?
Well, the process for adjustments and revisions at the municipal level will allow for municipal officials to update the information we have at the local level. So effectively, that plan is being updated at the local level, and we can, over time, update our plan. Well, it's a critical mass, but I would recommend we not do it every time there's updates.
Well, see, I have a different answer to it, and that is that, you know, today we say to half of the crowd, or 25%, whatever it is, and on our email site, tell us about all of the upland forests that you're aware of that Steve Balzano and company haven't identified yet. One. And we may actually get some information back before October 26th. And then, two, we'll also be doing that during the public period out to December 31st, or whatever the date turns out to be. That's an even more effective check and balance than the planning board or the municipality somewhere who we're prepared to oversee.
And I just... You know, I will take a leaf out of Kurt's book. At some point, it seems to me that this is overkill. I mean, if we can't identify it with all the help from the public that we will get as a forest that, you know, we've defined as a forest, why should somebody else be forced to do it?
Yeah.
Okay. But you don't want to answer that. I think I know what you're saying, Mimi.
Tom, I just want to clarify that, I mean, we will continue to gather data. We will release this plan at some point in time, and we will continue to learn more about the details of the Highlands area. And you're saying that we can't really incorporate them? We have to wait 6 years?
No. That was the requirement. We have to update every 6 years. That no way precludes us from doing it more often. I'm just saying I don't think this council will be wanting to update it every time it receives additional information.
But that doesn't mean we can't act on new information.
No.
I think what's being said is, as we go to the municipalities, inevitably, we're going to miss stuff, because we're looking at things from aerial maps, we're looking at things from all the best sources of information that we could gather. Yeah. And those maps are made, and then there will always be some stuff that needs to be filled in.
And that would be updated in our database as part of the forest resource area.
Find it. And then that automatically becomes part of the
That's
plan.
Right, because yes.
When we find another forest and you get out your magic marker and call it that overlay green.
I'm just saying it doesn't change the underlying master plan.
Right.
Because then the standards apply. If it
yes.
is a forest and it meets the definition
right.
for a forest and we missed it, but the standards still apply.
Yes.
So it's just a matter of fine-tuning at the site-specific level. We can't that today.
Item number 8, second bullet, we've covered that. Item number 9, pre-conformance strategy. So this is the recognition of providing detailed guidance to municipalities of what the requirements are going to be to implement the to conform to the regional master plan. There are three issues relating to forests. One is our technical guidelines and procedures to develop a forest stewardship and management plan on publicly held land. Item number 2 are guidelines to develop a forest protection restoration plan for inclusion in master plans, zoning and land use ordinances, essentially how to protect forests.
And that land use ordinances is where I thought we'd be talking about timbering, tree cutting ordinances.
Yes, so you have to get a building permit to clear more than 3 trees on your property, and that's a way of controlling.
And then what you have to do to restore or balance that.
Yes.
Okay. Now, some of these technical guidelines that we keep saying that we're going to develop, for example, do the pine lands have some of these already developed that we can steal or borrow? Or?
Yeah, there is. When we get through agreeing of what the policy criteria are or the guidance, where the council wants to go, then there are a lot of standards, procedures, examples of ordinances that are out there. It's just a matter of sort of customizing it to meet the council's desire. So there's a lot of material.
A lot of them we can put together
yeah.
fairly quickly.
Yeah. Putting material, yes, yes. But we're still anticipating that pre-conformance process is a 3 to 6 month window.
And we're doing that, or we're requiring municipalities?
No, pre-conformance is something that staff will do to give municipalities clear guidance on what they have to do during conformance.
I've certainly, just repeat myself, I think a chunk of this ought to be done in the next 2 weeks. That's not to say that more can't be done, but
we will certainly do as much as we can.
And I don't think any municipalities are going to try to gain conformance in 60 days. Just don't see that happening. It's not a worry.
Yeah, we're going to have 2 meetings that we're going to discuss conformance process and procedures, and I think a lot of this will be covered under that. And those are coming, actually, next week. Again, the importance, the last bullet, importance for low-impact development practices and developing technical guidelines. That is common throughout, and we will continue to develop that. Item number 10, conformance strategy. So these are now the requirements that towns that want to conform with the plan is the requirement for municipal conformance includes a forest area inventory that we could provide the information, the protection standards approval guidelines consistent with resource protection of the regional master plan. So they have to provide for protection of forest. That those forest protection restoration plans will be included in the master plan, zoning and land use ordinances as appropriate, and that the forest resource area will be included in the conservation element of their master plan. So they acknowledge that they have forest resource. That's the high quality forest. They acknowledge that they have it in their municipality. They know where it is, And a lot of that base information is provided to a municipality in our regional master plan.
You know, I want to go back to the point that we discussed before about the data. And I understand that the data we have will not be perfect and will be based on their photography that's 50 years old. But when you show us the thing up there, the slide of forest cover and gradations of forest cover, how specific does that get? Because I thought that does get down to municipal level and even down to a property level.
It is very specific, but it is not when you go, let me give you a scale. Mapping like this is done from a remote sensing perspective. So you're essentially looking using aerial photography at a relatively large scale, I think 1 to 2,000 feet generally, just as an order of magnitude. And the rule of thumb is you capture all mapping units that are at least 1 acre in size. That means everything that's less than 1 acre, you don't try to capture, because then the mapping gets too confused and it's too prohibitive an effort. When you go to site plan review level, you typically work at scales of 1 to 50 feet or 1 to 100 feet. So the level of resolution and detail is much greater, and you can capture more detail and higher degree of accuracy as a result. You don't want to lose the ability of, over time, of making sure that resources aren't lost as a result of resolution and accuracy that's inherent in doing a plan for 850,000 acres at 1 to 2,000 scale. And that's normal practices for municipalities that are accustomed to working at a site level at 1 to 50 or 1 to 100 feet. And we want to make sure that we can capture, like Tracy indicated, capture the resource protection goals and strategies where it's appropriate and justified at that site level when that site comes for review.
So when we adopt a plan, or even when we propose a plan, you're going to have data, or we're going to have data that shows forest cover sites that are over an acre in size.
Yeah, and we'll show, based upon that information, what lands include forests that are regionally significant and are not.
So since we answered some of your questions, Michael's question before, it's different. I mean, we will have that data. You guys can rebut it.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
That wasn't the way I heard it before.
Yeah. Effectively, most municipalities would go through a resource inventory, a natural resource inventory. We will be able to provide them with a baseline resource inventory.
Yeah.
But can't this overlay a tax map?
Yes, it does.
So then we will know down to the block and lot level where these forests are.
Yes, that we've mapped, yes.
Right, and then we can upgrade them as we go forward. But
yes,
we'll be able to say when an applicant comes in, yep, they've got a forest there.
And you're within this zone. Yes.
Right.
Remind me again, what's our definition of forest?
It's an ecological community that consists of trees and woody vegetation.
Right. I thought you had a distance component to it. So
part of the resource area, was it?
Oh, what we call one of our metrics or measurements of forest quality is proportion of total forest. We look at all forest cover within three kilometers, but forest is defined as any land that has trees on it.
But in that case, I think we probably need some work on the definition.
Of forest. Yeah, I think we
do. But you define a forest resource area.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So people do agree with 500 acres.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So well, it's those forests that are within, meet those thresholds.
Yes.
I had misunderstood forest and forest resource area before. If a forest were a forest resource area, I would understand that. It may not be the right definition. But then it seems to me this stuff about how fine you're getting goes out the window, because the area that you're looking at is bigger than the nuances you're talking about, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not equating forest with forest resource area with respect, I think we need to redefine forest. Because it sounds to me like if you have two trees on a
10-acre plot of land. It's a forest.
No, we had I don't want to get into it, but we had the council some time ago actually adopted a specific method defining what the forest is, and you have to have a certain number of trees over a certain unit area. It's a point-based system. The number of points are assigned by the size and number of trees. If you have so many points, it's a forest within a 10-foot radius sampling plot.
Is that in here as I look at the definitions?
It's included by reference, but we didn't include the specific
definition. We actually did a resolution by the council. When DEP's rules initially came out, we were...
I'll be able to find it. It's on our website.
It's on the website.
It's on the website.
I'll be able to find it inside.
So September of last year, we did that.
Thank you.
Item number 11.
To be explicit about it, that continues to be our real definition.
Correct, and it's included by reference in this. That's what item number...
Eight does.
Eight address. Highlands Council alternative method for identifying upland forest areas in the Highlands is specifically the resolution that was adopted by Council. Item number 11, five-year resource protection planning goals. Certainly the coordinated agroforestry program throughout the Highlands region. We want to make agriculture and forest stewardship encourage it as much as possible to increase economic viability of agriculture.
Could we have a definition in the glossary for agroforestry?
Certainly. Item number two is propose an amendment to the Farmland Assessment Act to include sustainable management provisions and yearly income adjustments for societal benefits provided by small forest woodland owners. Essentially, we want adjustments that doesn't require a landowner to have to extract trees in order to generate money to qualify for farmland assessment. If an owner will adopt a management plan, that doesn't mean they make any money from it, but they're managing the health of the forest, that should qualify. Right now, they have to extract trees and make money to qualify. And it sort of gets to what Kurt was talking about a little earlier. Last item is establish a cooperative monitoring program in forest health within the region. With the U.S. Forest Service and Division of Forestry, forest health is something, although we're talking about forest cover, forest health is another issue, gets to the issue of deer overbrowsing, invasive species, regeneration, and that there's a whole slew of both native and introduced pests that are affecting forest health and has such effect ecological viability and watershed protection. Things like the woolly adelgid, which is an insect from Japan that was introduced and is now pretty much decimating the hemlocks of the region.
If I may just go back to your prior point about farmland assessment. In reality, I think the proposal to have some sort of incentive not to harvest trees based on our goals and objectives in the Act are solid, but to get an amendment in the Act is nearly impossible. Everybody talks about it, but nobody really opens it up. But what does qualify is farm program payments. Already, you know, that's how land is set aside, and not crop land is set aside now, and there's program payments, and the program payments qualify as income to qualify the land. So I think the tack to take on this is not to seek an amendment in the Act, but to have a program in place where instead of having to cut down the tree to generate the income, stewardship practices are rewarded through, good stewardship practices are rewarded through an incentive payment, which then qualifies farmland assessment.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, and the stewardship program right now, the way the Act is set up, doesn't qualify unless you get an actual monetary benefit out of it as the landowner. So that's an excellent. I would suggest leaving both in there because we can still work for an amendment to the Act, and you know we could get there. And I would suggest also in that bullet when you talk about that, to say societal and ecological benefits surrounded, provided by small forested woodland owners, because there are definite environmental benefits to keeping the forest intact. I like the stewardship. I had that someplace else, but I think it actually fits here better under the five-year resource protection plan goal.
Item number 12, coordination and consistency. Cooperated with the New Jersey Forest Service to create and maintain a Highland Certified Forester and Logger program. I mean, this is a way of getting at the issue of less than scrupulous forestry activities, and by developing a certified program where you're encouraging good, sound forest management practices that are consistent with the goals, resource protection goals of the RMP, without regulating the use. Coordinate with, again, the Forest Service and U.S. Forest Service to develop standards for sustainable forestry practices. Everybody acknowledges the need to improve and refine how forest management plans are developed and make them more targeted at good stewardship practices and less susceptible to inappropriate stewardship practices.
Now, let's say that somebody who starts clearing a forested area which we've identified to be protected, who would be responsible for arresting the person or fining them or whatever? Is it
That's Roger.
A municipal thing?
No, I'm sorry.
Whose jurisdiction, legal jurisdiction, is this fall under?
Well, if the town had an ordinance, and ultimately the intent is to have town has a tree clearing ordinance, then the building inspector can cite
stop work order,
issue a stop work order, and cite the property owner for a violation. If the activity is regulated under DEP rules, DEP has policing powers and can take enforcement action under their rules. We don't have policing powers.
We don't
so.
Have.
Well, no, actually, we actually can go into court and get an injunction. Our enforcement powers are somewhat limited, not like DEP's abilities to issue administrative fines.
Now, maybe what we want to do is to also recommend municipalities ways to better enforce this stuff with really heavy-duty fines. And then you have to go back to the courts and see just how big a fine you will be allowed.
You know, that's a really excellent point. Because state law limits municipalities' ability to fine, this would be a perfectly appropriate time to make the fines.
So somebody clears 100 acres and we're allowed to charge them $1,000, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That's a good point.
We should call them a Highlands police.
You can be the chief.
Let's try to get through the remainder of this process and we get into the agricultural paper.
Coordinate with DEP on controlling deer populations within managed woodlands. I could argue within all woodlands and farmland areas that deer overpopulation is a problem, and will continue coordination with the Department of Bureau of Fish and Wildlife. Develop a coordinated regulatory program at DEP to ensure that their permitting activities are consistent with our resource protection goals, and again, coordinate with USDA Natural Resource and Conservation Service to encourage compatible conservation and management planning on existing farms consistent with the resource protection goals of the RMP. Those are pretty standard across all resource elements. Item number 13, local participation considerations, two educational and training components for municipal officials, one dealing with how to develop a forest protection and restoration plan within their municipality if they choose to do so or are required to do so. The second is develop forest management and stewardship plans for their publicly owned lands. And with that, ends forest.
So we'll move on to agriculture.
Yes. We're agriculture. Kim's going to lead the discussion on the agricultural policy recommendations that are the next subject. Do you want, Mr. Chairman? Do you want to run till 4 and then carry to the next meeting?
To start, there is a definition of agroforestry in this paper.
Thank you.
Okay. This is staff recommendations for agricultural protection and sustainability requirements. To set the stage, there are approximately $120,000 acres of agricultural land use and land cover in the Highlands region. Only 27,000 acres have been preserved. So a lot more than just purchasing preserved farmland needs to be done in order to protect the agricultural areas in the Highlands region. And I just want to point out that sustainability, I've used, the definition is on page 11. I've used the 1990 U.S. Congress Farm Bill definition. And it's generally accepted. And while there's a definition of sustainability, there is no equation for magic formula for sustainability. Okay.
When you say 120,000 acres of farmland, how do we develop that number, and what doesn't it?
That was the land use land cover from 02 that the DEP used. It was developed from orthophotography aerials.
Photography.
Yes.
Have we checked it with a farmland assessment notion at our
We have looked at the farmland assessment data. The problem with the MOG 4 data is that it not only includes assessed farms, it includes assessed forest managed lands, so that there's no breakout, there's no distinction in the blah and blah between agriculture and forest lands that all have assessed farmland assessment. So that wasn't very good for this analysis. Okay, the first.
What's the total land base that is farmland assessed? Do we have that? What is that?
We do have that number, but if I could get it to you later.
But significantly higher than 120,000.
Yes.
Yes, and I believe it's in the paper that's on the internet.
That's right.
Okay.
I don't know if it's is it higher than that.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, just to keep talking out loud about this, you've got 44 or 47 municipalities. Each of them has a taxing authority. Maybe this is way too much, at least I want to ask the question. You go to each tax assessor and say, I'd like to know how much of this is woodlands management versus how much of it is farmland.
We looked into that when we were looking at ag and forestry. There are no easy records for woodland managed plans. You have to go to a basement of a dark room in Trenton and go through paper files to get that information. So that's one of the goals and down the road is to put that on a database.
So woodlands management isn't in your role?
No.
Yeah.
No. Okay. The first staff policy recommendation is that that in the regional master plan that we protect the agricultural resources in protection areas in order to maintain and enhance the region's agricultural industry. Okay. The second recommendation is to establish agriculture resource areas and a land use capability map to protect the important agricultural resources. The agricultural resource area includes contiguous areas of 500 acres or more where parcels contain important agricultural soils and are designated as existing agricultural land use. Okay.
I'm going to wait for Tom to come back. Well, but I'll ask the question anyway. If I were running the zoo, I'd be awfully concerned about creating takings from a legal point of view, from a constitutional point of view, compensatable takings. It sure seems to me that this is pushing into that, maybe bizarrely from everybody else's perspective, in a way that the Act doesn't in and of itself. And so I'd like to get plugged into this, a legal perspective, if it's all right with my fellow council members, to ask Tom to spend some time thinking out loud with us about this question. I mean, if I heard you correctly, I should have started here from. You're saying we're going to tell a whole series of landowners who are farming today mm-hmm. that they can only keep on farming.
What I'm establishing is a area that we have determined to be very important agricultural lands in the Highlands. That's all this is doing, just like the forest resource area. This is the agricultural resource area.
I think your question is an important one that sort of is under or over this whole thing of where do we want to make exceptions or have flexibility or need to do that in terms of avoiding takings if that's where the policies would otherwise be leading. And that's going to be true for a lot of policies, I think.
Well, everything here really mirrors the same track that we took with forestry, and
right.
We're talking about exempt activities specifically listed in the Act, so we recognize that there's a good from having this activity occurring, and in many ways it's compatible with the goals, so it's only through an incentive and through recommendations that we can hopefully get everybody on board with this.
I understand.
I agree with you. Maybe I've flip too far and confuse things, but I have something that says prohibit land development or land alteration within an area. And that's where I was leading to the view that we're talking
about. You can go back to the original, the Act itself, and the DEP rules are not applicable to most agriculture or horticultural use or development. So we start there. So we have a very large group of activity that is not under the DEP rules. They're not exempt. They're not subject to the DEP rules.
But they could be subject to our plan.
In that we can ask municipalities to put things in their master plan with ordinances and so forth.
You see, I think, and you may be right, but that seems to me it involves the right to farm statute very directly, which basically says municipalities cannot impinge upon the right to farm, that's back at a state level.
No. The Act also takes into account that we can't infringe on the Right to Farm Act. I don't remember the section.
And I think the intent of those standards are to encourage farming and to discourage alternate uses that would impair that farming resource.
I think our primary goal to limit the change from farmland to non-agricultural uses.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you define an agricultural resource area as something with 500 contiguous acres.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't have any lower gradations to define farm.
This isn't intended to define a farm. This is intended to identify those farms
that are
part of an important agricultural area of the Highlands.
This seems like a high number.
Well,
we had a 5-acre farm in Precipitate, and I thought it was really valuable.
But in terms of defining a resource area, this isn't defining what the farm is. It's the resource area. And contiguousness is a major factor.
What are we going to put in the LUCM?
And the land use capability map is informed by the agricultural resource area, or that portion of the Highlands that includes the farms that have the greatest regional significance. Not all farms, but those that have high regional significance.
Well, which ones are they going to be?
There are the farms that fall within the agricultural resource area, which is defined to include those farms that consist of at least 500 acres of contiguous land area that are currently farmed.
It doesn't have to be one farm, as I understand.
Correct.
Right?
It's contiguous area.
Right. Maybe it'll help. It's an agricultural land mass that is not separated by intervening non-agricultural development. That's the area we're putting together.
Do we have an overlay?
Yeah. Same as forest. Okay, so it's all agricultural land uses throughout the Highlands region.
That's prime soil. Yeah. Where's the one with the...
That's prime soils over there. Sorry.
Important soils.
So that's the soils with ag uses.
There it is up there. The, above the red box is the 500 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, the red box is the 500 acres. So the red box are where there those contiguous properties that include farm agricultural uses that are more than 500 acres in size. Not the individual farms, but contiguous farms.
And farm that properties. Includes woodland in between, you know, the African...
It can include, yeah, it includes the entire property that constitutes the farm, which may be a portion of forest.
Quite a bit of woodland.
Right. Yes, exactly. And in fact, there's a lot of overlap with woodland.
Oh, right. So you're saying some of the red is actually green?
No, the red are the farms. When we define a farm, it's the entire lot and block that may include, that includes a portion of tillable soil. So, and what we did, if go ahead and turn on the... Yes. So we defined that portion of the Highlands region that includes those regionally significant farming areas. Not all agricultural use, but where is the most important agricultural uses or agricultural resources in the Highlands. And it's defined by that area.
And importance, in your view, is basically size.
It's size, continuity,
and soils. Most important, soils and
continuity. Are there any 500-acre parcels that are excluded because of soils?
Mm. Well, the selection process is you have to have an agricultural use that includes a component of regionally significant soils. So if it doesn't have soils as a component of its agricultural use, then it wasn't considered in the analysis.
And were there any of those?
I don't know. We could look at those. Okay. But I don't believe, I think the soils is fairly extensive. If you look at turn on yellow, there's a lot more soil than there is agricultural.
There's over 300,000 acres of prime soils. Unfortunately, most of it is under development.
Who knew that?
Soil survey.
It's just, it's well drained soils.
What's the total acreage you think of agricultural resource areas?
Well, the agricultural resource area, as shown by that black line, is about 300,000 acres.
Well, it's shown by the red line.
No, the red area, which are the farms that define the agricultural resource area within it. I'm not sure what the acreage is on that. But we can get to that number. But.
Is the 500 acres, I don't mean this pejoratively, arbitrary? Did you look at 250 acres?
We don't use arbitrary standards. What we try to do is rely on best professional judgment in the absence.
There's a background for using that.
Where did 500 acres come from?
Well, one of the places it came from was from the U.S. Forest Service 2002 update study. And that was one of the factors that they used in coming up with conservation values for agriculture.
Because
contiguousness is important in terms of preserving a farmland community, productivity. There have been studies on this, and it's considered an important factor.
Well, again, that's the kind of information that needs to be in the rationale when you're saying that this is the definition of an agricultural resource area.
I will tell you, from working in the Midwest, is they chunked out farmlands by 1 mile square, which is about 600 acres, because that was the amount that you could till and manage as an individual farm. So it has...
I can move it. Much of the explanation is on page 11.
But you did not look at 250 because that's just not available. Or you did look at 250 and rejected it for another reason.
250 contiguous acres?
Yes.
Because we set the threshold for regional significance at 500 and felt that represented well the distribution.
And you did not look at 250?
Correct.
You know, we may need to consider two tiers or something, because a lot of the background for the 500-acre selection is based on what's going on in the rest of the country, which is much different than the agriculture that we have here. And for a grain operation, for a sizable dairy operation, big contiguous tracts is really important. Or the more intensive fruit, vegetable, ornamental production, you can have a very successful operation out of much smaller tract, and doesn't seem to me we want to exclude very successful operations just because there's not 500 acres of contiguous land. And the reality is we've got a lot of suburbanizing areas in this Highlands region where there's going to be these smaller farms broken up, but it doesn't mean that it's not a successful, viable agricultural operation.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And so I think we need to be careful not to exclude just based on size. Maybe we catch it some in another way.
I mean, there's an acknowledgement that most of the farms are small. I mean, the average farmland in the Highlands region is only 55 acres. The average farm in New Jersey, not just farm, is 81 acres. So statewide, we're talking about most farms being way under 500 acres. It's just a matter of the land mass to, that forms all these farms. It's a factor even the SADC uses when they're considering the proximity to other preserved farms or other farm operations. It's a factor that's used in most preservation policies.
It's only one. It's one ranking criteria,
right.
But there's a lot of other ranking criteria that can offset a bad mark on contiguous can be offset by lots of really high marks in another area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, such as local.
There are two uses of this policy, as I said. One is restrictive in saying that we want to do everything we can to keep these lands in active farming use. The other is enhancing to say we want to try to steer whatever SADC or other resources are available to help support these farms. And Kurt's point is important that there are farms outside that are not within a 500-acre contiguous area that we might well want to see supported in.
I don't think any of the policies that we're recommending, though, would be to their deficit.
But I think it would prioritize within the resource areas.
Just to add your observation, a third lake is we called upon to do a resource assessment, which calls upon us to identify farmland. And I think we'll be in a funny position if we ignore a 400-acre farm somewhere that happens to be by itself. So to the degree that this is meant to be covering our resource assessment, and I thought it was, but correct me if I'm wrong,
yes.
I don't think it's adequate.
Okay.
I think if community to defend this.
No.
I was going to suggest moving on to a couple, so we can get a couple more policy areas out on the table.
Those are the forms.
We could stop beating in the dark.
That's all ag use?
That's all ag use.
You can see this is with all agricultural uses turned on and how we're capturing, using the criteria, the vast majority of existing agricultural uses. So there is going to be agriculture uses outside, but I would guess if we did an analysis of area that we're probably approaching or exceeding 90% of ag use within that resource conservation area.
I had the opportunity to meet with Kim earlier this week and went through things. And of course, after you have 48 hours, you digest and come up with some other ideas. The one thing I would say is, contiguous land is an element, but I'd say that in examining how we protect and sustain, enhance agriculture in the region, there's probably some elements more important than the 500 contiguous acres. So I would suggest that we really consider maybe having two tiers or something.
We could do that.
Or having a lower standard, because I think that there's a lot of black speckles outside of the dark lines right now that a lot of communities would say are really important. And I think if we connected some dots and put the forestry on there, they probably are contiguous to some of these forestry areas, so then you've got some combined open space uses that help further our goals.
Why don't we revisit that after the meeting? We can talk about a more aggressive analysis.
Okay. Three. Recommendations that the criteria for the regional conservation zone of the land use capability map include all areas identified in the agriculture resource area. That's our last phrase. Number four, resource protection standards should include the first dot, prohibit land development or alteration within an agriculture resource area that is incompatible with the protection and management of important agricultural soils and other natural resource protection requirements. Okay, dot number two. Limit permissible uses within an agricultural resource area to the maintenance of pre-existing uses and the uses of land that support the preservation of farmland and its continued viability. Okay. Three, include agricultural resource area within municipal zoning and land use ordinances, including site plan and subdivision review criteria. Fourth dot, require the incorporation of the agricultural resource area within municipal and county farmland preservation plans. Five, encourage the utilization of the agricultural conservation practices within the agricultural resource area that conform to the resource protection standards of the regional master plan.
I have a point on that one. I think this is probably, to me, one of the most important provisions or standards. And when we've seen the data about the condition of our streams and waterways, we see a lot of the problems do result from agricultural and proximity to agriculture. So I think that we should say something a little more active here, like something like develop a program to utilize agricultural conservation practices, not just encourage, be a little more hands-on here to make sure this really happens.
Okay, I think we'll find something a little later on. I'll make that note here.
Okay.
But there might be something later on in the paper that'll do that. Number six, encourage the application of agroforestry practices and techniques to cultivated farmland within the agricultural resource area and forest resource area.
I didn't see that in the glossary.
Okay, let's see. Okay, it's on page 14. It's not under the glossary. It's under examples of sustainable agriculture conservation practices.
Oh, at the bottom.
At the bottom there.
Okay. And does it also mean using more BMPs than normally?
I think you would include BMPs in the practice, but it's the integration of the benefits from combining trees and shrubs with crops and livestock. So, but I think all of the BMPs that would be associated with any of those farm activities would be utilized in addition. Where are we here? Okay. Seven. Encourage owners and operators of farmland with woodlots to have approved woodlot or forest management plans within the agriculture resource area that conform to resource protection standards. Eight, encourage the inclusion of appropriate wildlife and invasive species management techniques in any management and stewardship plan developed by a state, county, or municipal government within the agricultural resource area and make it part of conformance and consistency. Nine, encourage the use and expansion of current agricultural conservation practices and cost-sharing programs. Okay, that's sort of a subset of the one from before. 10, encourage the preservation of agriculture resource areas through easement and other preservation methods.
Can I raise a point?
Yes.
If on bullet one we say prohibit land development, period,
mm-hmm.
and then we say encourage easement, it seems to me if we're going to absolutely prohibit, then we have to pay, not just encourage to pay.
No.
I mean, if we're going to take, and I think this goes to the point you raised earlier, Mike.
It does.
That if we're going to say you can't do anything else but farm, then we better be prepared to ante up. Mm-hmm.
And I think
because you know nobody's prepared to be a serf to the king.
And I think what item one speaks to is land development activities that impair important agricultural soils. So treating soils as a resource and protecting resource. That's not prohibiting all uses on agricultural land. But Mike had an issue earlier of expressed a desire to discuss the implications of taking in a situation where the RMP may limit uses on farms to just agricultural uses, and does that create any concerns with regard to taking, if I characterize that?
Yeah, no, that's fair, and I don't want to hear it this afternoon, but I like it.
We'll gladly follow up.
And I guess generally in everything that we're doing,
yeah.
But I think Kurt and I would agree that this seemed like it, if it wasn't a taking, was it closer to it than anything else we've done so far. Could be wrong about that.
Well, the flip side of that is to, if you're going to prepare an opinion for us or give us one, is, you know, to what degree the council can indeed regulate use and conversion of land in order to protect agricultural soils and agriculture, the agricultural industry, and the land base, as Steve just described it.
There's been recent cases on it in the Amwells and the Gardner case back in the Pinelands, so I can prepare something for you.
And then I would counter and say, well, what use is there in preserving private farmland and living on it?
Well, we can argue the policy part of it. I just, right. You guys are bringing up a constitutional issue, which my understanding of Gardner and East Amwell and a couple other decisions in New Jersey is that it's neither here nor there. You can't regulate farmland. You can regulate and restrict the uses on it, you know, without it constituting a taking. So the starting point ought to be, what's the appropriate policy? Is limiting particularly residential development in agricultural areas necessary or appropriate to preserve farmland? You know, you look at that map, and you look at the areas that doesn't have any concentrations as defined in these thresholds, and that's the area where development's been allowed. And I think it's hard to argue that there's not an inherent conflict between development and the retention of agriculture. But I just want to make sure that the debate is on policy grounds and what's authorized and directed for us to do by the statute, as yours point out, and not on constitutional grounds that may not be applicable.
I disagree a little bit, because I'd like to know up front whether we're close to crossing a takings line. And I hope the answer is we're not. And then I just throw the whole thing out the window. And if Tom were to say to us, yeah, you've crossed the line, I'd like to know that up front, even apart from...
I think we'd agree we're going to discuss this subsequently.
Yep.
Here in our meeting. Part, so.
Okay, number five. The smart design recommendations are require ordinances consistent with the Right to Farm Act, which provide protections for active farm owners and operators and allow flexibility in regulations to accommodate the need of agricultural operations, such as seasonal needs, parking, temporary signs, off-site signs. To require the adoption of compact development ordinances, including a mandatory cluster provision within the agricultural resource area, dedicating at least 80% of the site to farmland and open space preservation.
I have a comment on that one. I think it's probably assumed, but it might be good to actually say where environmental conditions allow, to make it clear. You can't always put a cluster everywhere. It depends on your soils.
Okay. Six, conformance strategies include, one, require municipality or county with agriculture or horticultural resources in the agricultural resource area to include these areas in farmland preservation plans and conservation plan elements of their respective master plans. Two, encourage a municipality or county with resources in the agricultural resource area to develop an agricultural sustainability plan that includes the incorporation of local agriculture industry into an economic development plan. Three, encourage the development of an agricultural sustainability plan that includes the use and expansion of marketing practices such as alternative marketing and community-supported agriculture. Four, develop technical guidelines to assist municipalities in the development of agriculture element and agriculture sustainability plans.
I had another suggestion for another bullet here. Something along the lines of developing technical guidelines based on the NRCS and other agencies that lay out how ag conservation practices can conform to the resource protection standards of the RMP. I think that connection is going to be kind of new for municipalities, and the more we can lay that out, the more helpful it'll be.
Seven, the five-year resource protection and planning goals are, one, maintain an inventory of active Highlands Region farmers. Two, continue to coordinate and standardize data collection on state and county agencies regarding open space and farmland preservation.
Do we have a definition for farm?
We have a definition for active Highlands Region farm.
Okay, I saw it capitalized, but then I didn't see it under farm, so it's under A.
Three, develop indicators to serve as an assessment tool in meeting agricultural and horticultural goals and policies. Okay. Eight, coordination and consistency considerations. One, support full capitalization of programs that purchase agricultural properties either in fee or by easement and encourage farmers to utilize these programs.
Excuse me, I had something back on before we get into 897. To repeat the bullet that we put under the forestry about going for, this is where I had going for an amendment to the Farmland Assessment Act. Now maybe it doesn't need to be here, but I think it would still apply because there are farm practices that benefit habitat and there's various incentive programs. So to develop that as an alternative to producing a certain amount of crop in order to meet your farmland assessment requirements.
Okay. So I'm on to 8.2. Encourage the preservation of agricultural resource area farms under the SADC preservation programs. 3. Assist the development of a forest easement purchase program that can be utilized by SADC and the New Jersey DEP Green Acres program. 4. Support the extension of the dual appraisal method of the Garden State Preservation Trust Act under the SADC preservation programs beyond the June 30th, 2009 date. The appraisals are calculated using two values, including Pre-Highlands Act January 1, 2004 and the present day values. And the higher of these two appraisal values are to be utilized for the basis of negotiation. 5. Coordinate and standardize data collection among state and county agencies regarding open space and farmland preservation. This is all under the heading of Department of Agriculture, SADC, and the Garden State Preservation Trust. And 6. Establish incentives for preserving farmland in exchange for a landowner's agreement to permanently restrict the amount of impervious surface and agricultural impervious cover on a farm to a maximum of 5% of the total area of the farm.
Now, you said that's established in the Act, correct?
That's 6W under the powers of the Highlands Council.
Which part of that is?
6W, I
believe? That last bullet is restricting the Act.
It's from the powers of the Highlands Council.
So the Act tells us that while we allow farms to have up to 9% and even more with the special resource management plan, on the other hand, if we encourage through incentives farmers to agree to 5%, then we can do some extra stuff for them. Right? Am I characterizing that correctly?
Absolutely.
And Kim, while we're on that, does that exclude now the intense use equine farms that have been under discussion for some time and aquaculture or shrimp farming, for example?
It falls under the definition of agricultural use, and I would say no.
Right.
Where does the crossover come between an agricultural use that's exempted and when that use results in a water quality impact? The aquaculture facilities are a big problem. It can be a big problem.
Well, I guess if they have to be following agricultural management practices under a right to farm, and if they weren't doing that, then that's where, or you didn't have a site-specific practice for the CADB?
If you exceeded the,
right.
the percentage of impervious coverage.
Right.
Well, then perhaps we should consider, and I had a note here about adding a bullet, about how we can work with agencies to make sure that their best management practices are harmonized with our goals, our resource protection goals. Okay. I mean, it's kind of implied in these others, but to make it very clear that what our goals are and to make sure that the various programs, such as the best management practices that are prescribed in the, on the right form, do reflect and accomplish our protection goals as well.
And so coordination and consistency considerations with federal funding agencies, encourage additional funding for agricultural resource area farms under existing federal funding programs, recommend increased funding for programs that support the use of agricultural conservation practices and the development of new programs in the Highlands region. Under the Department of Agriculture.
Wait, Jim, I want to honor the idea of NDEC being a set for Barker rather than making a speed read through this last section. We'll put this on the agenda for next week to finish it up. And one thing I said, I've marked it up here, I'll give it to you. There are a couple of things in the rationale that read to me like policies. But other people have comments. We're meeting next Thursday at 4, five to 10 minutes after we adjourn this meeting. We'll have a public comment period, and at the close of the public comment period, there's a meeting of the local participation committee that's open to the public. Is everybody clear there?
John, okay. Just one request in terms of homework.
Yes,
I have to think. And that is under
this
five.
This is the first one, you know, but go ahead.
No, I understand. Well, with under five, just if you all can come in prepared to show where allowing cluster development in coastal areas, what that's, how that's played out in other parts of the country, where it's actually resulted in the preservation of farmland. And since you're talking about the agricultural resource area, I understand direct easement on a piece of land, but we're always talking about broad ramifications. I'd like to see that justified.
Any other comments?
John, did
yeah.
you say we are 4 o'clock now next week?
Yeah. I didn't say that.
We're
at 10
o'clock.
We are at
10 o'clock.
Next week. I guess I'm sorry.
Well, you had me smiling.
I'm sorry.
You had me frowning.
Is there a motion to adjourn? Any other comments?
So moved.
I'll say.
All in favor?
So we good with
Debbie? I don't
forget
that.
Depending on the weather, if it's a beautiful day, maybe we don't put it on first on the agenda. We can kind of just pick it up later on.
I was going to push to get this done now.
If it's a rainy day, I'll be here on first. If it's sunny, the mornings are tough.
As we have the last 2 weeks, we're going to have a public comment period now. We welcome comments from anyone. I would ask one question. If you are commenting and are interested in addressing this question, one of the things we have to address as council is how long a public comment period to have once we adopt a draft plan. And it's one of the things the next committee meeting will be discussing.
among the choices are to have a 30-day comment period, assuming we come out with the plan late October, have a 30-day comment period, and try to absorb the comments and adopt the plan by the end of the year, hopefully. Another option is to have a longer comment period, and obviously a longer comment period would delay the adoption of the plan by roughly the number of days we lengthen the comment period. So it's something we're wrestling with, at least I am, and if anybody has comments on that, we welcome them, but you're not obligated to say that. So, comment, who would like to speak? How many people? So we have three, okay. Mr. Shirk, you went last week, so you can go first this time.
Oh, you want me to go first?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is David Shope. I live in Long Valley. A couple of things. On steep slopes. People have been building on steep slopes, including here in New Jersey, for hundreds of years. I can take you for a short ride up Schooley's Mountain, where they've carved out of the mountainside and built stone houses hundreds of years ago. They have not slid into Schooley's Mountain Road. They remain as they were. This isn't rocket science. This council should learn from the building techniques of the past in terms of what happens to the land around these buildings and the techniques used to keep the buildings planted. I think a lot of this is unnecessary. Groundwater recharge. What economic benefit will landowners derive for the limited use of their land so that the water can be collected and sold to privately owned water companies? The one up to the north of us is owned by Suez in France. The one here, served by Round Valley and Spruce Run, is owned by RWE of Essen, Germany. They make profits. They ship them home. What will my benefit be for collecting this clean water at the same rate and the same quality so that the downstream neighbors, as they're referred to, can use the water, treat it to a lower standard than we have to treat up here, dump it in the ocean, polluting my ocean? That's in the form of a question. The water that is used up here by virtue of septic systems and wells recharges 80% back into the ground. Water that leaves the area varies anywhere from 75 to 100% consumptive to the watershed. This is stupid. This is completely contrary to the issue of water conservation, the good use of water. It's the antithesis of it. Forestry. Number 11, bullet number 2. I consider this as nothing more than a tacit admission of the need for subsidies for agricultural viability, in this case of forestry. And even at that, what will the return on equity be? I think it'll be essentially non-existent. And ag, as far as we went, Mr. Salavera raised the question about a taking. I say, why avoid a taking? If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, maybe it's a duck. When you take essentially, and you have case law to substantiate that, you cite it in your own reports, where 90% of a taking is not a taking, that to me sounds like 90% of a duck. It's a taking, call it a taking, and pay. And the report that I read on sustainable agriculture did not contain a single dollar sign. Seems to be sustainable means economically viability. It should be the same. I didn't see anything in here to substantiate economic viability of agriculture. In fact, information that I previously given to you, and I notice it's not cited here, that is to say the 2002 USDA report on agriculture in New Jersey says in most cases it's not viable. Simple as that. Don't ignore it. You can't sweep it under the rug. It won't stay there. Sustainable agriculture. Why have the agricultural equipment dealers left the area? When I have to order parts for my John Deere, I get them from Pennsylvania. my international tractor, same thing. The agricultural dealers have made their assessment as to viability in the state, and they've left it. They've closed up. The average farm size in Hunter is 70 acres, in Warren County is 90 acres. According to the 2002 USDA report, the 70-acre farm in Hunterdon County lost $12,000 per farm. Warren County, it made $4,000 per 90-acre farm. This is a very pathetic return on equity. I don't know what you're talking about when you talk about agricultural viability, because the only way you can attempt to accomplish it is to reduce the land value to essentially zero. And a couple of cases were mentioned, Gardner and East Amwell. They have both only gone to the New Jersey court system. They were not taken to the federal system. I think you would get a different result in the federal system. And this, quite frankly, is nothing more than a transfer of wealth bill. The wealth is being taken out of our hides up here as landowners in the Highlands and transferred to the cities using water as the conduit. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Council. I'm Tom D'Alessio, Regional Plan Association. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to speak to the issue you put on the table about the question of public involvement, timing, and the adoption of the plan. I'm the last person to say that this process should go longer, a minute longer than it should, and after today, I don't think I'd find any friends, even if I tried. But it is an important process. Having gone through the state planning processes, having served on a local planning board, having worked with a number of mayors and other folks to advance local and regional plans, the most important issue that we always have before us is process. And the most important component of process is trust. It's critically important that the public trust the process and trust the information that they're receiving. And part of that trust component requires the ability to synthesize and read and analyze the materials. I have a concern that the time frame is very short, that even if you were to release a draft plan within a month, that it would be very, very difficult to adopt a plan by the end of the year if you engaged in what I consider a comprehensive process. I use as a mentor Joe Marizidi in the state planning process. Say what you will about the state plan itself, no one, and I have yet to find actually anyone, who would criticize Joe Marizidi and the process he established. Now, there was a bit of a problem with that. Joe made sure that every last person had their say and made sure everyone had a chance to read the plans, make their comments, and then that the staff of the State Planning Commission to actually consider how to address those comments. The concern that I have is if you try and adopt a plan in the next 2 months, if you're releasing it in the end of October, you may have a 30-day comment process. You then have the task of asking the staff, not only during the holidays, which you know should be considered a little bit of time for the staff to have some time off, but also during a very crucial time in the year to synthesize information. And if it's a situation where it's perceived, and I know it won't be real, but if it's perceived that the public doesn't have enough time to comment, let alone their comments matter, then I think you start off on the wrong foot with the adoption and implementation of this plan. So to bring it full circle, I don't know that the issue of whether it's a 30-day or a 60-day process of the comment period is as critical as you make sure that you have enough time to allow the public to read the documents, to analyze them, not only to comment, but also to then hear what they have to say. And then if there need to be changes, to make the changes on that. That may require you to consider an adoption in January or early February, or maybe a little bit later than that. And I don't have the answer to all of that. Just to say that I think you're on the right course. I think your committees are addressing these critical issues, and I think you'll get there as you go through. If you'd like, I'd be glad to volunteer any advice I may have, and if I may, I may even volunteer some of the folks who went through other regional and statewide planning processes to give these suggestions to you. Last but not least, as I briefly mentioned, the whole issue about the holidays. When I start looking at my calendar for November and December, not only do the national holidays come into play, but then we start thinking about what matters most in New Jersey. regarding governance. The League of Municipalities Conference is coming up. There are a number of other critical efforts that are happening. A number of us have children that have various school days off, et cetera. That may complicate your ability to have public hearings and meetings. So in that sense, giving yourself an extra month or two may not necessarily be the worst thing. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth George Nair, Staff Attorney and Highlands Policy Coordinator for the New Jersey Builders Association. NJBA members are concerned with the Highlands Council policy papers presented at these work sessions. These policy papers inform the Highlands Regional Master Plan, Policy Guidance, Land Use Capability Map, and Implementation Framework components. However, these policy papers are problematic on several levels. In them, council staff suggests various strategies that assume necessary underlying decisions have been made. However, the council has not discussed them as a full body, at least not in a public forum. The approach of being blind to the line pervades the analysis. However, it is clear from discussion during the work sessions that this approach is still not accepted nor understood by all council members. The policy papers reference three overlay land use zones and three standards that would be applied in the three components of the RMP. While the council scoping document and release of preliminary technical information briefly outline these three standards and describe six, not three, land use capability area, the council itself has not discussed nor voted upon these very important standards and zones. Nevertheless, the staff has been and apparently will continue using these zones and standards to form recommendations for the various RMP elements. Work session discussion indicates that council members themselves do not have a clear understanding on their application. For example, today's discussion shows the need for policy discussion and decision making even for specially planned areas, which is referred to in all of the policy papers. As such, the current process results in each element being applied to the RMP without a clear understanding of its effect. Prior to the review of any additional policy papers, the council should fully review the overlay land use zones and standards in a geographical context so that the council and the public have a clear understanding of where these zones are located and which standards are being applied to which zone. Further, it should be explained how the zones and standards are applied in the two distinct areas delineated in the Highlands Act, which is clearly not blind to the line. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Nicole Goger, I work for New Jersey Farm Bureau. We actually would like to comment on a number of things that were discussed today, but right now I'm just going to concentrate on the public comment. Over the past three work sessions, the public has observed a large amount of information being provided to the Highlands Council, a lot of which is very controversial, and you know, there's been no public input as the discussions have been happening. The public has not been given very much time to review any of the information or policy recommendations that have been coming to the council, and nor have we been given the ability to review many of the background documents. In the beginning, we were seeing background documents, but more recently, we haven't been seeing those. In light of this, of all of this, it is obvious that the draft regional master plan will be very large and very comprehensive and take a long time to go through and review everything. We feel that it is very important that the public have enough time for this review, and based upon your end of the year deadline, it's not likely that that would be provided if you were to have the RMP adopted by the end of the year. Farm Bureau feels that it is insufficient, and 30 days is insufficient amount of public comment, and we would need at least 60 days to review the RMP. We understand that this would mean extending the deadline, and although on the one hand, that's disappointing to us because we have a lot of farmers and landowners that are in need of this, of some guidance in the Highlands. We feel it is even more important that they are included in the process and can hopefully cite their opinions on much of the controversial issues before a final draft is adopted by you. Thank you.
Nicole, what
did you mean by, and I'm not going to debate this, but I just want clarification on, you said you were seeing background documents before and you're not?
In the very beginning of these work sessions, some of the issues discussed would, on the internet, they would place up what would they would call it, the staff called the background documents. Then the first work session happened and your shift switched to the policy documents. And since then, they've been putting some policy documents online, mind you, not very far in advance of the meetings, but not all the background documents. For instance, today, the recharge areas and that 40% recharge, we haven't seen any background on how that number came to be. And in order for us to comment on these policy decisions that are being made, we need to see the background as well.
Well, we eliminated the background documents,
didn't we? Mm-hmm.
We consolidated
so that we had one document.
The white papers. We're
I understand that, but
it's getting confusing for everybody.
Okay. I understand that for the purpose of the meetings, but for the purposes of people trying to comment on your policy decisions, which are based on these background documents, it's important we see some of the science and background that goes into these decisions.
Well, what we recommended today on several occasions was that, for example, the 40%, that the calculation or whatever be included in the rationale section of documents or whatever.
There aren't, as far as I know, background papers that you've seen the same background papers we as council members have seen.
Right. Yeah, right. So. Right. But that doesn't mean that they're
no,
not
I understand.
Out
there. All right, thanks.
My name is Deborah Post, and before I begin, I'd like to just say for the record that public comment today is a bit of an insult. We are sitting here speaking to an empty room, which tells you exactly how much the council, which has largely left this room, really cares about what the public has to say about the development of the regional master plan. I would like to begin my comments today by qualifying myself as an expert on the subject of business viability. Today I am a farmer. In my previous life, I was a managing director in the restructuring department of a major investment firm, responsible for assisting bankrupt and troubled companies. I was an expert witness in bankruptcy court, a court-appointed trustee to divest financially troubled companies, and had an expertise in raising funds in the capital markets for difficult situations. I hold an MBA from Harvard Business School with honors and a specialization in finance. I hope that qualifies me as an expert to speak on the subject of agricultural viability. Agriculture in northwestern New Jersey is not generally viable. There may be niche markets, such as greenhouses, corn mazes, and farm tour birthday parties that approach profitability. But these are the exception, not the rule. Community-supported agriculture is fanciful silliness. Traditional farming, vegetables, fruit, hay, corn, and cows, do not generate revenues adequate to cover the high expenses of operating in rich people country, New Jersey. Farm labor is non-existent, completely non-existent. Towns tax old barns and employee housing on old farms as if they were McMansion estates. I must grow and sell 16,000 pounds of apples just to pay Chester Township. Support services are not priced for farmers. They are priced for the price-insensitive corporate executive that lives next door. Insurance is another huge expense. As Warren Freeholder, Mr. Gardner, notes, farmers must sell wholesale, but buy retail in their cost structure. The bureaucratic burdens of the proposed resource protection standards that I heard here today will add excessive and unbearable costs to a farmer's operation. You need to know, even though there's no one here to hear me, that no one will farm under the standards being proposed. No farmer is going to farm under the direction of a bureaucratic moron. If your goal is to provide farming, is to promote farming in the Highlands, you are doing precisely the opposite. Viability is more than covering one's expenses, and in good years, maybe having an income left to put food on the farmer's table. If you were to be a fly on the paper of a farmer's cash flow statement, you would notice that many, if not most, farmers today are funding their operating losses with debt. It's very sad. Viability is earning an adequate equity return on invested capital. 10% adjusted for inflation is a historical equity return often noted in textbooks. I am sure Mr. Salavara, who has left, would find a 10% equity return woefully inadequate. But let's use the 10% for today's argument. A farmer's invested capital includes the value of the farmland, agriculture's key capital asset. Show me a farm that makes a 10% return on the $200,000 acre at which Chester values my land. Beneficial use is economic beneficial use, not hiking trails and turtle habitat. Farming in New Jersey is a labor of love and foolish nostalgia. There is no economic agricultural beneficial use that provides an acceptable equity return on invested capital in the New Jersey Highlands. When you tell us that we still have an agricultural use, I hear Marie Antoinette's ghost shrilly proclaiming, if they can't develop, well, let them farm. You will recall that the street mobs cut her head off.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak?
I'm Nancy Chambellan with the Warren County Environmental Commission. I first would like to commend the council for its attention to groundwater resources and not just concentrating on surface water. As I've said numerous times here, Warren County is entirely dependent on groundwater for its water resource, and our resources were placed in the planning area. So I really am feeling a lot, very much encouraged by the discussion this morning that so much attention has been paid to protecting groundwater as well. I also found it interesting, and I think it was in our forestry discussion when the suggestion was made that the council levy additional fines for violations that may be coming up in the future for ordinances. The only thing I would ask the council consider, should that come to pass, is that the monies from the fines that come in not be put in the general New Jersey Treasury, as they are with the DEP, and that somehow be reserved for the council and maybe put into incentives and restoration projects instead. And my final point. Pardon?
The money will probably go to the municipalities. They'll be
well, that would be okay, but not the general treasury.
Excuse me, I'm the treasurer of this body.
Oh.
I know where the money.
I know where the money.
My final thought for the discussion today was, again, to thank the council for recognizing agricultural areas as high-value resource and for your efforts to through incentives to try to support and facilitate farming as economically viable in the context of environmental stewardship. This goes a long way to support our local efforts in Warren County to work cooperatively, such as the Buy Fresh, Buy Local things, and the Food Shed Alliance, where chefs and farmers and community members join together and commit to purchase the products to help the farmer be more economically viable. I do appreciate your efforts to perpetuate the community, our agricultural community that's not just farmers, but all of us who are interconnected with the farmers, who depend upon them for our quality of life. And I appreciate you making such a strong effort in those areas.
I just had a question. I noticed that the public comments were on a separate sheet, not attached to the minutes. Will they be submitted with the minutes now to Trenton?
Question.
We did not plan on doing that since it wasn't part of the advertised session of the minutes that we were covering.
Can you do it with a cover letter explaining that? I think the governor and others down Trenton need to know what the public is saying, even, quote, unofficially, unquote.
Yeah, we can make sure that it gets to the coder's office and the DEP.
as a matter of routine, not just not just.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think that concludes the comment period. So, thank you all. And
we now go to the participation committee. Hang around a little bit.
Good. We're here.